Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, October 16th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho issues execution warrant for death row inmate who survived botched execution earlier this year. Pullman City Council changes certificates of inspection rules for code violations. And we'll have interviews with Latah County Commission candidates, Republican Tony Johnson and Democrat Mark Thorne, who are running against each other. That's all coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. A judge issued a death warrant today for convicted murderer Thomas Eugene Creech, who survived a botched execution in February when the Idaho Department of Correction execution team could not find a vein to inject the toxins. The team tried 8 locations on Creech's body. The judge's order comes the day after the correction department announced it had updated its death chamber so workers can use central veins of prisoners in order to kill them. The department said they will begin using central veins deep in the groin, neck, chest, or arm of the death row inmates. Death Penalty Information Center Executive Director Robin Marr said Idaho will become the 3rd state in modern history to try to execute someone a second time. Alabama executed 2 death row inmates this year after failed attempts, but Alabama used a different method than the first attempt. Alabama killed Kenneth Smith and Alan Miller using nitrogen gas. Marr told the Associated Press, anytime there is a botched execution and the public are not given a full and meaningful understanding of what went wrong, it prompts additional concerns. We know Mr. Creech's execution failed because the execution team could not access a vein, but we have not received any complete information from the Department of Correction about why that happened or what steps have been taken to prevent a similar mistake from happening in the future. Instead, we see them pivoting to a new method of accessing a vein. The defense team for the 74-year-old Creech said Idaho is, quote, sacrificing common decency and humanity, unquote, because they are in such a hurry to kill him. The defense team issued a press release which said, we are heartbroken and angered that Idaho would try again to execute Thomas Creech using virtually the same process and team and executioners and before conducting any official review of what led to that botched execution attempt to take his life earlier this year. The level of recklessness puts Idaho in a class by itself, as other states that botched executions took significant steps to examine what went wrong before trying again. Creech has been a prisoner for 50 years. A court sentenced him to death for beating a fellow inmate to death, 22-year-old David Dale Jensen. That murder occurred in 1981. When his case went before a clemency board, a former warden at the Idaho prison where he stayed, and prison staffers supported his bid to stay alive, saying he was a generally well-behaved prisoner. The Idaho Republican Party has argued on their website that Proposition 1 is a plot to engineer election results to turn Idaho blue. Despite the opposition from the state Republican Party, which has been taken over by a far-right extreme faction, support for the initiative comes from Republicans, independents, and Democrats in all 44 of Idaho's counties. Campaign funds in favor and against the initiative have been significant. Proposition 1 is a grassroots initiative on the ballot this November, aiming to make major changes to Idaho elections. The first is to create open primaries where all candidates for public office would be listed on the same primary ballot, regardless of party affiliation. All voters would be allowed to cast ballots in the primaries, unlike the current system where Republicans restrict the primary elections to those who affiliate with the party for a certain amount of time before the primary election. This would also effectively open the primaries to 275,000 registered unaffiliated voters. The second is to establish ranked choice voting for the general election, with the top four candidates advancing. Idahoans for Open Primaries, a political committee, has spearheaded the financial support of Proposition 1. Reclaim Idaho co-founder said of the grassroots support of Proposition 1, quote, "The entire campaign was launched by ordinary Idahoans and funded from day one by the contributions of thousands of Idaho citizens, and along the way we've raised large contributions. This campaign is so important that thousands of Idahoans have been willing to contribute to it." Idahoans for Open Primaries has raised $2.8 million, $900,000 from Idahoans, and $1.9 million from out-of-state groups. One such group is the Colorado-based Unite America PAC, which supports party-neutral reforms to improve representation in elections. Opposition funding to Proposition 1 is significant, collectively spending more than $460,000 in electioneering communications. That does not include undisclosed expenditures by the Idaho Republican Party. Your Health Idaho's open enrollment started yesterday and will last until midnight December 16th. Idahoans can pick from 13 insurance carriers and more than 170 medical and dental plans. Certified agents and brokers are available free of charge to assist Idahoans with their applications, plan selections, and potential tax credits. Idahoans already enrolled through Your Health Idaho will have their policies automatically renewed, but they can only change their policy during the open enrollment period. The Pullman City Council voted last night to change city code to limit the number of certifications of inspection the city will issue to landlords for code violations to 2 per year. According to an agenda item for the meeting, Whitman County District Court, which provides City of Pullman Municipal Court Services, has interpreted city law to require code enforcement officers to provide requested reinspections of properties and to issue certificates of inspection regardless of the number of prior or pending infractions at a single premises or against a single person. City Code Enforcement Officer Jericho Dahlin explained the situation at last night's Pullman City Council meeting.
And the reason for bringing this ordinance to updating this code is to limit the number of these certificates of correction that can be issued in a single calendar year. And the reason for this is there have been instances where a single residence or single premises gets multiple citations in a single year because they get a citation, they clean it up. They get another citation, they clean it up. And so it isn't promoting compliance. It's just a way to avoid paying the fines. And so if they're unlimited, if they're entitled to unlimited certificates of correction, then it doesn't really promote compliance, and which is what we found. And this came to a head recently when there were multiple challenge citations, and because the code enforcement officer had not gone out every time he was requested, because there was continuing and there was multiple and continuing ongoing violations, the court dismissed all of them, because saying that the section 1.02.130 required the code enforcement officer to go out there and issue a certificate of correction. So what we've done is just amended the ordinance just a little bit to again limit the number of certificates of correction that can be issued at for a specific premises and or responsible person.
The agenda item for last night's meeting said allowing serial certificates of correction discourages proactive compliance, promotes compliance only post-infraction, and contradicts code enforcement objectives. The agenda item said limiting the number of certificates of inspection to 1 per year would balance compliance with tolerance of and opportunity to correct isolated violations. However, Councilmember Ann Parks argued that limiting the number of certificates of inspection to one per year seemed harsh and suggested limiting it to two certificates of inspection per year.
Going from unlimited to 1 year to one time a year seems harsh. And the thought that comes to mind is, as Officer Dalen mentioned, we often have turnover in residences in occupancies, typically at semester break. So I'm just wondering if we could amend, and this is just a discussion, I'm not suggesting this, but if the language could be amended to either two per year or one in a six-month period. And that sort of allows for this group of people being held to the one time. But then if the property changes over somewhere later, it could even be in the summertime.
Most council members agreed with Parks, and the council amended the motion to a limit of twice per year and then voted to pass the change of city code 6-1.
KRFP thanks its listeners and supporters, including the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at PalouseFolk.org or on Facebook.
KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of north central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
An update to the Northwest Forest Plan is expected soon, and Washingtonians who enjoy the outdoors are being urged to follow the process closely. While the plan doesn't specifically mention recreation, the Northwest Forest Plan is the land management plan for millions of acres of forest in the region. Michael DeKramer with the Washington Trails Association says the U.S. Forest Service should keep in mind the people hiking trails within the plan area.
Outdoor recreation is the primary way in which the public interacts with those lands. So this management plan is key to assuring that there's continued conservation of resources, but also opportunities to recreate and enjoy the forest in the Pacific Northwest.
DeKramer says the outdoor recreation economy is also important to the region. It generates more than $26 billion annually in Washington, according to the Outdoor Industry Association. The Northwest Forest Plan was adopted in 1994 for management of forest in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. The U.S. Forest Service is set to release a draft environmental impact statement for the plan amendment next month. Among the factors the Forest Service plans to address is the impact of climate change on the region. Betsy Robley with Washington state-based group The Mountaineers says increasingly frequent wildfires are hurting trails. She contributed recommendations with the Federal Advisory Committee on the plan amendment to address this.
Restore recreation sites after climate-related events and reopen them to the public. One thing that we're seeing is more lengthy closures of areas after wildfire. Places can be closed for a number of years for public access.
Robley encourages people who enjoy recreation to follow along as the Northwest Forest Plan Amendment is released, because there will be an opportunity for the public to comment on it.
It's easy for folks to think, oh, this is all about logging or wildlife and it doesn't affect me, but it definitely affects people's recreation experience and the places that they love and care about.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Tonight, we continue with our series of interviews with candidates in local elections. Tonight, we have two interviews, one with Democrat Mark Thorne of Viola, who is running for Latah County Commissioner from District 1, and another with his opponent, Republican Tony Johnson of Viola, who is running for the same position. It's a two-year term this time, and it will fill the seat now held by Democrat Kathy LaFortune, who has decided not to run for re-election. In the other county commission race this year, incumbent Democrat John Bowman of Troy is running against Republican Jason Stooks of Moscow. Democrat Tom Lamar still has 2 years remaining in his term as county commissioner. So now we have our interview with Mark Thorne, which was recorded yesterday at KRFP.
I grew up farming and ranch work and that type of stuff. And that was, you know, that connects me with this area because the area that I farmed in was somewhat similar. We got about half the rain or less, but so that connects me in that way. But also I got to see, you know, firsthand the effect of bad policy in the 80s. You know, we were in an inflationary period, granted, in the 70s. And in order to fix that, the Paul Volcker, the then Fed chair in the Reagan administration, increased interest rates dramatically. And that's what threw the country into a recession, major recession. And it really dismantled a lot of family farms and that type of stuff and put pressure on lending agencies. And then in order to recover from that, they introduced the Conservation Reserve Program, which on the surface sounds great. We're going to conserve land, not have it erode. But that wasn't the intent of the Conservation Reserve Program. The intent was to take land out of production and then have that, you know, increase the demand on grain commodities. And so and that really hurt the counties because the services and stuff that was provided to farmers was no longer there. I mean, there was no demand for that. A person over in Whitman County had figured up some estimates, and it was in, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year that was lost to county budgets because the CRP program paid landowners, not farmers. If farmers and landowners were the same, then it was one thing. But the CRP program pays landowners not to have their land farmed, which is a major issue. So, like in Whitman County right now, I've looked at some data. The average distance that a landowner lives from where their farmland is somewhere around 100 miles. In Latah County, it's somewhere around 40 miles. So we're talking about people that live somewhere else from where their farmland on average. So that's just a mat. You know, it's like when we do these, it just opened my eyes to when there's policy changes, we've got to figure out, you know, who the winners are, who the losers are, and how we're going to, you know, keep the losing end, you know, from being totally decimated. And that was the reason that I left our family farm, because the farm credit situation had deteriorated, and the land base that we were farming had diminished because a lot of our land was leased land. I decided to go education route instead of working for another farm or whatever. That got me into doing some interesting graduate work in land revegetation and seeing how policies. Well, the Midnight Mine is the first one during my master's program, and I was looking at you know how to get a native grass vegetation cover established on very poor mine spoil that wouldn't hardly support anything other than weeds. And, you know, it was looked at from several different ways. The Corps of Engineers was looking at it from a situation of trying to control vegetation because they felt the roots would channel water down into the pyrite, which is iron sulfide material that turns into sulfuric acid when it gets wet, and then that leaches minerals into groundwater. And so they wanted to keep that from doing that. But from a biological, ecological point of view, you want to have a good vegetation cover to absorb that moisture and keep. I did my doctoral graduate work in Ohio looking at revegetation of a coal mine land that had been surface mined and actually reclaimed under the law. And so, but it was interesting, the reclamation laws that came into place in the 70s required that, you know, topsoil be stored, and then when the mining was finished, the land be recontoured and topsoil be spread on top, and then a vegetative cover similar to what was there before was to be established, which sounds great, but all that recontouring and everything was done with very heavy equipment. And what that did was create a compaction zone that the native deciduous forest vegetation could no longer survive in. So they and they had 5 years to get a vegetation cover going. So and really the only thing that can do that is some forage species. So they the whole process turned one of the most diverse forest systems on the continent into hayfield and pasture. And so, you know, it's, looking at that, it's like, well, you know, great. We stabilized an area that had been mined in a way that was at least not causing issues downstream. But it could have been done better.
Okay, and you mentioned that you got out of farming because of agricultural policies. Are there policies on the horizon that county commissioners are going to have to look out for, you know, maybe on a national level that will affect the county?
You know, I don't know what's coming down the pike, and certainly every presidential change or election, you know, can make a difference. The federal crop insurance system is definitely important at this time to keep farmers competitive in the market, what market there is, and I think that, you know, that's something. The margins right now on farm products in this area is pretty slim. You know, they might be growing three crops, you know, three crop rotation, and maybe making money on one, maybe two of those. So that's, you know, this the economy of this area is fairly dependent on the agriculture that we have, and so that's concerning. You know, another issue that farm policy or that we're facing here is problems with herbicide resistance and weeds. And we have a species called, the common name is Italian ryegrass, but it's really just annual ryegrass that has been growing here since, I don't know, 70s or so, and now is resistant to most of the herbicides that were used once. A farmer over in Whitman County told me, he said, yeah, it wasn't a problem back in the 80s, we just kept using this one particular herbicide until it didn't work anymore. And that's what's going on now. And a number of farmers in this area have told me straight up that particular weed is changing the way they farm. You don't see much spring wheat, but you see a lot of spring canola. And that's because they can use the glyphosate-resistant canola and still effective in controlling the Italian ryegrass. But that particular species is capable of developing resistance to glyphosate. In fact, in Western Oregon and Washington, there's orchards with glyphosate-resistant ryegrass. And if when that arrives here, when it develops here, there's going to be more and more stress on how farmers do their job. And I know we have a noxious weed person. Italian ryegrass is not a noxious weed. It's everywhere in the Palouse, in the wetter areas. So I don't, you know, it's county can't really do much about that particular species, but it's certainly something that is going to be an issue countywide for the agriculture areas. But that particular species is capable of developing resistance to glyphosate. In fact, in Western Oregon and Washington, there's orchards with glyphosate-resistant ryegrass. And if when that arrives here, when that is won't arrive, but when it develops here, there's going to be more and more stress on how farmers do their job. And I know we have a noxious weed person. Italian ryegrass is not a noxious weed. It's everywhere. in the Palouse, in the wetter areas. So I don't, you know, it's county can't really do much about that particular species, but it's certainly something that is going to be an issue countywide for the agriculture areas.
All right, I want to talk about housing because the idea of creating a housing authority on a county level has come up. And what are your thoughts about what many perceive as a housing crisis in Latah County? And I'm sure it's happening all over, but Latah County specifically, we do have prices going up. We have mobile home courts being bought up by investment firms and imposing new rules on people, and it's making it very difficult for renters and or people who want to buy homes. So your thoughts about housing?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a critical issue, and we had moved away from the Palouse for about 14-15 years and moved back and experienced the increase in housing costs when we moved back. And it's, you know, from my perspective, I know it's real, and from people that are needing lower income type housing, it is a crisis. And what's interesting is our state law, the land use planning law, actually requires that we accommodate low income housing and mobile home parks. It's in the law, and how we do that is, you know, the housing authority may be one way to approach that. It's going to take several different options. The housing cooperative structure is potentially one way. If a housing cooperative can come together, they at least don't have to, the money that they pay into that cooperative at least doesn't have to go to paying another company's for their profits. I mean, it stays within the unit, which is good. And then the other, obviously, the Moscow Housing Land Trust is another approach that is being used and being effective. And so that essentially takes the land cost out of the cost of having a home, because that land cost is amortized over almost 100 years or whatever at 0% interest. So that type of thinking, the market is what's doing this, right? The market is what, you know, this is, like I said in one of the forums, that Idaho has become a destination state and Latah County has become a destination county within a destination state. So it's put a lot of pressure on everybody. I mean, builders, realtors, homeowners, people with, you know, that are trying to get first time home. I mean, it's a major issue, and we need to really focus on what we can do with the budget situation that we have. Once the nice thing about the housing authority is all the county has to do is set up the housing authority structure, you know, the people and then the county backs out and the housing authority takes over. They're responsible for getting the loans, the grants, the land, putting the housing together, all of that, and that doesn't affect the county budget. The county might have to do some readjusting of the area of impact around towns to accommodate that type of work, but that would be that's just paperwork, right? That's just plan. Well, it's more than that. It's working with the cities and towns to figure out where that area of impact should go, so that it doesn't, you know, doesn't infringe on things it shouldn't be infringing on.
What are your thoughts about local preemption laws that the legislature passed? I suppose the 3% limit on increasing your budget per year is one of them, and there's a bunch of others. So tell me a little bit about the relationship with the state, since you've sort of started down that path there.
Yeah, so, you know, this has been a steep learning curve for me, because I've not been a candidate or not been in county government before, and so since April I've been, you know, trying to find out what the job is all about and what goes on. But I see that there's been a limitation on being able to have a local option sales tax, which would pay for the jail that needs to be replaced, and or could pay for it, and that's something that we need to work out with state government. I think the state government has put a lot of emphasis or a lot of weight on local counties to pay for, or in property tax to pay for the school system, and that's causing a burden. Idaho doesn't rank well in state spending for K-12, so that puts pressure on the whole system. Some of the other, you know, the all of the limitations I'm not aware of, but the sense is that there's been the state is causing the, you know, putting a lot of responsibility down at the county level to pay for things, and that is that maybe needs to be looked at more at a broader basis.
That's Democrat Mark Thorne of Viola, who is running for Latah County Commission against Republican Tony Johnson this year. The winner will serve a 2-year term. They're running for an open seat that is currently held by Democrat Kathy LaFortune, who decided not to run for re-election. We now have our interview with Republican Tony Johnson.
I'm Tony Johnson. I'm fourth generation Latah County resident, currently living in Viola. Graduate of Moscow High School, past business owner. I worked for the family business for well over 50 years in the trucking and excavation business, and bought my family out about 25 years ago, so owned and operated Johnson Excavation for 25 years. I was on Moscow City Council for 6 years back in the 90s. And interesting times back then. We got the Hamilton Low Aquatic Center built, wastewater treatment plant built, Alturas Park built, improvements on Mountain View built, lots of subdivisions went through. We were busy back then. It was fun. Currently retired. My wife sold the business in May, so in the construction field, it gives you a lot of opportunity to learn how to get projects done. And, you know, back in the 90s, it was just what was happening then. Moscow was grown at about 3% in the housing market back then. I think it has slowed down considerably now, but it's just the economic times we live in.
Yeah, so you mentioned housing, and I believe the county is in a housing crisis, and you know, a lot of people are seeing their rents going up, getting priced out, and new rules in the trailer courts and so forth. And I was wondering, I think that might be an issue that county commissioners might have a little more sway over. I know they're limited by the state government what they can and cannot do, but talk about housing.
Well, yeah, housing is an issue. We've been in a terrible inflationary cycle over the last 3.5 years, and that has taken the housing prices up substantially, which makes it more difficult for people to afford housing. So an idea that I would float is do this through the private sector. That's what I'm most familiar with. Personally, a housing authority in the county is not part of the county's business right now. It's not part of our job agenda. But we can do it through private business. Best way to do that is get with the people that have the money. If you go to the government to try to get money, I think you're compounding a problem. If you go to the federal government and try to get a grant, a subsidy, we're $40 trillion in the hole. So if you're trying to use government money, you're taking a bad problem, which is our national debt, borrowing against that to give money to people who can't afford homes. You're making two problems, and I don't believe that's the solution. The solution lies, believe it or not, with the billionaires. They have $2 trillion worth of assets and money that they are more than happy to give away. They do this through a 501c4. Read it in Forbes magazine about 2 months ago, and I thought, that's how we get our funds to build housing now. Set up a private corporation, not for profit. All this money is tax-free. So before the government gets that money, let's try to take it from the billionaires. Let's beat the government to the punch and get their money. They're more than happy to give it to us.
And there are housing crises in counties all over the country. Has anybody tried this?
I believe some have. This is new to me. This is, like I say, I've learned about this about 6 weeks ago. We're just now getting our feet wet. We're taking baby steps to see what this is doing. I've got some people doing some research on these 501c4s to see what's involved. Bill Gates is involved with it. His ex-wife's involved with it. I should have brought the article. I'm sorry I didn't.
Yeah.
It's in Forbes, October, November issue, 2023.
So if this doesn't work, is a housing authority maybe a second option in your mind? It seems like you object to housing authority because it might rely on federal grant money that taxpayers pay on the federal level, and also because it would be a public entity rather than a private thing, although I believe that they might try to utilize private money as well. But as an entity, I guess it is a public entity set up by the government, the county. Is it a backup idea even?
If push comes to shove, let me give you a little scenario. If the United States government owned all the sand in the Sahara Desert, they'd run out of sand in about 2 years. That's how efficient our government is. So it's a direction I really don't want to go. It's more red tape. It's slow, and I'm not used to slow. Uh-huh. You just mentioned a little earlier that in the private sector and the construction industry, we get stuff done. And I'm not used to doing things slow. It frustrated me when I was on city council how slow things worked. Yeah, we got it done, but something that should only take a year usually took 2 or 3 years.
Okay, and as far as addressing the billionaires, what would the money actually be allocated for?
Well, it'd be allocated for that C4 that you'd set up. And the transparency on that would have to be crystal clear. If they're going to give you, let's say they give you $2 million. I'm just using a number. They're going to want to know how that money is spent all the way down the line.
Would it go directly into building subsidized housing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so this is something, in fact, I was just talking with a gentleman today, and we're just now getting the ball rolling on this. So, yeah, we're taking baby steps. We're all learning. But I would rather run down this road and then try to go through government.
All right, let's talk about some other county issues. Maybe a general question, because before we started the tape, you said, I nailed it, that the state government allows you to do very little. The scope of the county government is somewhat limited. There's local preemption laws. And if you were going to lobby the legislature as a county, I guess there's the Idaho Association of Counties, what would, what would you lobby for?
Oh, shoot. Lower property taxes. That's a big deal. And the state dictates a lot of that. I did have a conversation with the Speaker of the House here a couple weeks ago. And he gave me his phone number. So I thought that was really generous of a man that's pretty much pulls the strings in the state of Idaho, would actually give a candidate his phone number that, hey, Tone, if you have an issue, you need some help, here's my number. I also have we have our two representatives and our senators that are right now on the Republican ticket. I'm heading to them first. But the other thing, I'm kind of joking here. I also have his wife's phone number. Because she's on the tax commission. And if you really want to get something done, you get the wife on the side of what you want done. Because if mama ain't happy, then Speaker of the House ain't happy.
Yeah, I suppose her being on the tax commission would be to the county's advantage here.
Let's hope so. I don't know if that's sales tax. I don't know what part of the tax commission she's on. But like I say, I have the phone number of the Moyle family.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal. Right. That's a really big deal. And plus we have the Association of Idaho Counties too, but you have to lobby, and you know, every candidate that's been at our forums has talked about lower property taxes.
All right. What are your thoughts about the new state system of public defenders? That's one responsibility that counties had that probably most of them didn't want, that the state finally took away as of the beginning of this month.
You know, I'm not up to speed on the public defenders. But been talking to Bill Thompson recently, and Bill says, come to my office, talk to me. I'll get you up to speed on everything you need to know. So this is one area that I'm not up to speed on.
Yeah.
So I'm just being honest with you. There's a lot of things I'm not up to speed on, but I will get there, you know.
And it does seem like it's an issue in the past now anyway. There's a lot of consternation on county governments in the last two decades about trying to pay for big trials. And that's another thing. There is a trial budget that the Latah County is responsible for. It's recently ballooned because of the Koberger trial to, I believe, $150,000 for fiscal year 2025. That's going to shift a few things around in the county budget. I don't know how much you've been looking at that, but...
Talking to one of the commissioners, as of October, the state takes over that bill. So that's a big deal. I'm hoping they're right.
The trial money, huh?
That's what I've heard.
Huh. Okay.
So I'm quoting another county commissioner. I'm not going to say names because I don't want to get anybody in trouble. Again, I need to talk to Mr. Thompson before I step into it.
Okay. Yeah, all the news stories that we've had so far was that the Latah County is responsible for the trial budget, you know, not for the public defense, because that's changed. Okay.
Yeah, like I said, there's a couple issues coming up that are going to cost us some money. You may get to the jail here in a minute, but that's another one, you know.
Go ahead
step
and talk.
At a time.
Yeah.
You want to keep going on the jail?
Yes.
Okay. At the last forum in Troy, my response was, what am I going to do? My first response is, there was a commissioner meeting on Tuesday. The jail should have been on the agenda. There's another commissioner meeting coming up this Tuesday. It needs to be on the agenda. Let's get the ball rolling. Let's find out exactly what we have to do. Do we remodel? Do we ship the inmates out? Or do we build new combination? Let's get our facts straight. Let's get exactly what we need to do up at that court, up at the jail to fix. I have some ideas. I haven't been in there yet, so I can't say what I would do. But I have local contacts that if I need them, I'll bring them in.
You're seeming to take a fix-it stance rather than a new jail stance.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We need to get the facts and what this thing is going to cost us. So before any commissioner really should say anything, we need to get the discussion started. That's where I'd start in, get this thing going.
I was talking to a sheriff's candidate yesterday, and he said the timeline for making a decision was the next couple months. So before you would be sworn in if you win the election.
If they can do that, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
You know, whoever wins this election will be sitting in on those discussions because it will affect what they do.
What are your thoughts about the remnants of Palouse Prairie habitat that we have in a very fractionalized state on the Palouse? It's supposedly one of the most endangered habitats in the world. It's the original habitat before the Palouse was plowed.
Another issue I'm not familiar with. So what I do, I'd go with Tom Lamar. Tom is very up to speed on that. And that's an asset. So if there is more habitat that needs to be planted, we can do it. I kind of think there may be bits and pieces of it, but this whole county's been farmed. Mm-hmm. You know, even where the new highway went, all that ground's been turned under once. So original Palouse habitat, yeah, maybe. Maybe there's some. I don't know.
Oh, people, it does exist.
People tell me it does.
I've been there. Yeah.
So they also tell me the Palouse earthworms exist too, and I haven't seen one. And I've done thousands of yards of dirt, and I've never pulled one up.
Yeah, I've seen them live. They've been found mainly on Paradise Ridge.
Yeah, I've never seen them. I'm in the excavation business. I've never seen one.
Yeah, the guy brought them to the University of Idaho Biology Center.
I'd like to see one.
I guess we're sort of winding down. I wanted to ask what thoughts you might have on differences in development opportunities on the two sides of the state line.
development opportunity. Well,
yeah.
I don't have anything. I can't do anything over, say, Washington.
Never, huh?
No.
Right, right.
I mean, we can't even extend a sewer line across state lines.
Right.
Even Amazon thinking about going across state line?
Who?
Amazon.
They're going to build in Washington.
Yeah. So, you know. So, anyway, so development on this side of the line, Moscow will take care of Moscow. Troy will take care of Troy. If it's outside in the county, we'll take care of that. But the development is mostly just housing. And if you have a permit to build a piece of property, you get to build on that property.
And I suppose there's differences, though, in what you're allowed to do.
It's from here to the state of Washington?
Yeah.
I dropped everything in the state of Washington. When I worked in the state of Washington, basically I called the state of Washington going over to East Germany to work. Everybody wanted me to show you your paperwork. Show me your paperwork.
Right.
And the cost of doing work over in Washington is way more than in Idaho. We have Washington contractors coming over here because it's easier to build.
It makes you wonder why Amazon decided to do it right on the Washington side of the line. I mean, there's probably some advantages, or otherwise people wouldn't make those decisions.
Can't tell you.
Okay.
I just got to.
Right.
I'm not saying. I don't know. I don't know why they're doing it.
Okay.
Maybe the land wasn't available over here. Sorry.
Yeah. So to sum up, why don't you, are there any issues that I didn't bring up that might be of importance to people who are thinking about who to vote for Latah County Commissioner?
Nothing. Just that's a controversy. More than likely, this is going to boil down to party lines. Mm-hmm. Who can get the most folks out to vote? I know all the guys running. The other three guys are all qualified just as I am. What do I bring to the table? I bring 25 years of business experience of my own business. I bring 6 years of business experience working with the city of Moscow doing city council stuff. So I'm going to say experience might be the biggest difference between me and my opponent. But other than that, my opponent lives a half a mile away from me. Great guy. He's a good guy. Bark is an awesome guy. You know, I'm native to Latah County. I'm hoping my heritage here might speak a little bit too, because this is where I grew up. This is what I want to stay as much Latah County as I can. I don't want to see us become the east side of Washington, Oregon, or California.
That was Republican Tony Johnson, who is running for Latah County Commission this year. His opponent is Democrat Mark Thorne. They are both from Viola. They are running for the seat now held by Democrat Kathy LaFortune, who is not running for re-election. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, 70% chance of showers tonight. Snow level 6,500 feet, lowering to 4,000 feet. Showers likely mainly before 8 p.m., increasing clouds, low 35. West winds, 5 to 10, gusts up to 20. Tomorrow, 70% chance of showers, mainly before 3 p.m. Snow level, 4,100 feet, partly sunny, high 49. West winds, 10 to 15, gusts up to 20. And mostly clear Thursday and Friday, low 27, high 51. Current temperature is 46. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, and the music and arts programming that we put on every day here at KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. There's more information about that on the KRFP website, or you can send checks to 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Membership's $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Flashpoints is up next. Lockdown Mosh Pit on at 7:30. Music begins in earnest with Grateful Dead Through the Decades at 8:30. Stay tuned for more.
Extinction Rebellion Palouse proudly supports KRFP. XR Palouse is organizing to have our governments and institutions declare a climate emergency, achieve climate justice and biodiversity, and leverage the power of arts and humanities to foster social change. KRFP is also sponsored by
Idaho AFL-CIO, dedicated to representing the interests of working people at the state and local level. KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors for helping make this programming possible.